Good morning. May it please the court. Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, Ernest Richardson. Reversal is required in this she said, he said case involving complaints made years after the alleged misconduct. The trial court defied two well-settled principles of law, that which prohibits the use of the testimony of one witness from vouching for the credibility of another witness, and that which requires the trial court to issue a limiting instruction when evidence admitted at trial can be used for both a proper and improper purpose. Here, the two complainants made statements to the Child Advocacy Center, and the state sought to introduce those statements at trial. And pursuant to 3507, they used the interviewer to introduce the statements. Unfortunately, the trial court allowed the interviewer to testify as to her own qualifications, the techniques she used in interviewing the complainants, and her own opinions. With respect to her qualifications, she told the jury that she had retired after 26 years as a lieutenant in the police department, and that she was trained not to ask leading questions. With respect to techniques, she also told the jury about the RADC protocol, which is designed to get children to feel comfortable and in a position to talk about something that might be really hard.
And your point is that by talking about her qualifications in that way, she was in substance, although not, you know, in precise form, vouching for the credibility of the out-of-court declarant?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's...
And I gather that you made that argument to the trial court and asked for an instruction? I mean, how did this issue come up?
What happened, Your Honor, was prior to the interviewer testifying, the prosecutor had sought to introduce the curriculum vitae of that interviewer. The defense counsel objected and said that, quote, the jury can make their own determination on credibility and everything else. He also said that Ms. Polly, the interviewer, really isn't offering an opinion. I think this bolsters the other witnesses. Now, the trial court said, okay, the CV doesn't come in, but I'm still going to let them do her testify to the qualifications. So it was preserved in that fashion.
Well, what was the basis for the exclusion? It's cumulative or what?
Your Honor, she didn't state. It was her apparent acceptance of the fact of his argument, but she gutted that ruling by saying that the evidence could still come in verbally. She didn't really explain that on the record, why she was doing an inconsistent ruling in that case. And to go back to your Honor's point, what happens is, what this court has found is that when the interviewer or whoever is vouching for the individual testifies as to their qualification, the net effect is to bolster and enhance the testimony of those witnesses and create, in Graves versus State, it was an attorney who told his witnesses to tell the truth to the state.
Well, help me here. I understand that there was an objection. Now, first there was an objection to the CV coming in. That was upheld.
Yes.
But the judge allowed live testimony by that witness about her qualifications.
Correct.
There was an objection made to that?
No. But what I would argue to the court is that...
So we're in plain error land, right?
No, we are not. And here's why. The substance of the argument here was included in his objection. His objection was that the jury can make their own credibility determination and that the introduction of her opinion or says she shouldn't be, she isn't offering an opinion. I think this bolsters the other witnesses. Now, in Wheat versus State, there was a similar case.
What, I'm sorry, you're saying that there was enough of the argument you're making now was communicated to the trial judge?
Yes, and here's why. In Wheat versus State, the court dealt with somewhat similar situation where there was a expert presented by the state, a social worker who testified about the truthfulness in general of witnesses. And after the voir dire, the court noted that the defendant made a general objection but did not later object to the testimony on specific grounds regarding the statistics and probability she testified to. And the court stated that such objection was included, however, in a claim made at trial that the expert's testimony amounted to inadmissible opinion and credibility, and thus the objection was preserved.
Well, help me understand the record here. This interviewer was not called as an expert.
No, she was not.
She was called to introduce the 3507 statement.
That's correct.
And under 3507, what we've held is it's the statement that's attributable to the declarant.
Yeah, that's correct.
What does the interviewer's background have to do with anything relating to the 3507 statement?
Nothing, Your Honor. And in fact, the state attempted in its brief to say, well, that was necessary to lay an additional foundation, and that's simply incorrect, because it is, as the court points out, the declarant has to touch upon the events and the statement and voluntariness and truthfulness. And there was no challenge. Nobody cross-examined her, the interviewer, as to whether it was voluntary. And even if there had, arguably, all of her testimony would not come in.
Where would you draw the line if the interviewer, can the interviewer obviously say who he or she is? The interviewer, can the interviewer say where he or she works?
I would imagine so.
That it's particularly the Child Advocacy Center?
Yes.
When at some point is there an inference that this person is experienced and trained in asking children delicate questions so that the truth is revealed?
Well, that's the problem here. There was no inferences that had to be made. The interviewer specifically said, quote, she was trained not to be suggestive or ask leading questions and just let the child tell their own story in their own way.
Well, I'm trying to determine what's the rule of law that you would advocate where the introduction of the interviewer has to stop. I thought I heard you say that they could say that they worked at the Child Advocacy Center.
Yes. It would be something along the lines as I'm Miss Polly and I work at the Child Advocacy Center, and what happens is when someone makes a complaint, they bring them in and I interview them, and this is the statement she gave me, and that's the end of it. There's no need to go into how she talks about. We get into what definitely has happened, and at closure.
So let's just change this into a hypothetical. If the interviewer was a state police person, I would assume that you would not want them to say, I'm a member of the police, that'd be fine. Mm-hmm. And then if they say, I've been a member of the state police for 25 years, I've interviewed 1,500 suspects, I've never had any court ever determine that anyone gave an involuntary statement, anything to elaborate upon why their interview was credible,
correct.
You would say is inadmissible.
That's correct.
Just to follow up, if I might, on Justice Holland's question, my hypothetical would, take the witness that we had, and the questions would go something like this, where did you get your undergraduate education at University A? Do you have any other advanced degrees? Yes, from University B, University C. If it stopped there with nothing further, would that cross the line?
Yes, fortunately, we don't have that close of a situation.
Because the next question is going to be, what kind of training did you have? Well, I've been doing this for 20 years, and we're very attuned now to child witnesses that are telling the truth and the ones that are not. I imagine you clearly would say that crosses the line.
Right.
But if you don't have that,
It still crosses. What's the relevance of her education? What's the jury's going to see this interview? And in this case, there was no objection to the back and forth dialogue. I think there were some redactions. So the jury was going to be able to see and make its own decision as to the questioning.
The answer might be that it's relevant to bolster the child. I forget the title that she had here.
Child advocate.
The child advocate's testimony. That is her credibility as opposed to the child's credibility.
And that may be. And if this were a closer case, then perhaps there'd be an argument there. We don't have that here. And what we have here is not just her qualifications. She also talks about we don't over-interview children, for example. She says police officers don't go into detail with these particular alleged victims because they end up giving different stories, and the story could change. And she says, quote, You don't want there to be conflicting information. It doesn't give the child much credibility. And she also testifies, quote, I think as far as truthfulness, I think it's very apparent when you talk with a child and go through that whatever, that's her words, I think it's very obvious when they are being truthful. And when she said, and that's at A36, and when she says that, and she's actually sponsoring the testimony, that is at least indirectly or implicitly vouching for the testimony.
So you're saying we don't really have to draw any fine lines here because clearly by any test this was over the line.
That's correct.
Okay. Did in the objection was made before or after that testimony or both?
Before the testimony, before she even took the stand, as to the CV.
And did the trial judge make a ruling? And if so, you know, was there a rationale, or was it just a one-word ruling?
I'm sorry. The court ruled that the CV was inadmissible, stating that questions about her background and experience to support her training as a forensic evaluator could be asked. No further explanation was given. And if the court has a problem with respect to the standard of review, the state even recognizes in its response brief at page 10 that this court has found plain and reversible error when the jury is permitted to consider a witness's personal beliefs that a victim is telling the truth. And in fact, Powell versus State, which I believe was a companion case of Wheat, noted that the defendant actually solicited the testimony regarding the expert's testimony about probabilities and statistics and reasons why witnesses recant, but said that it was plain error because it was a credibility case, there was no other evidence, the expert's testimony was a substantial evidentiary factor, and the prosecutor brought it up in opening and closing. And I will note that the prosecutor in this case did, in fact, in her opening, talk about not as far as laying the foundation. She said, quote, she's trained, talking about Ms. Polly, she's trained how to interview children, not just sex abuse, just children witnesses, trained how to ask non-leading questions, in other words, how to let the children answer. And so it was highlighted in the opening statement with respect to that was letting the jury know that that's what the relevance of that was. And without any...
Was there any indication that the... there was going to be a challenge to her questioning methods, that she was somehow suggestive?
Not that I could see. I do think that what happened was there was testimony, as her testimony without being challenged, the interviewers, was this, I don't ask leading questions. And then on cross-exam, the defense attorney talked about, well, you did ask a leading question here, didn't you? And you did ask one here. But the problem is, as this court has noted in 3507, she wasn't challenged. There was no need for it to be bolstered to begin with. And I would take the court's hypothetical one step further. We know that in court, the prosecutor is not to ask, or on direct exam, in this case, the prosecutor, is not to ask leading questions. It would be as if the prosecutor could get up there and say, I graduated from A University, I went to law school here, and I took trial advocacy, and I've been told that asking leading questions might not produce the truth as much. And so I didn't ask leading questions, so, you know, and it's apparent to me when witnesses are telling the truth. That would not, by any means, be appropriate. And yet that's exactly what's happening with the statement here.
I may be returning and covering old ground, but after you read the judge's ruling, it raised the question in my mind of whether the judge properly understood that the problem here was that, you know, the testimony of this child advocate would and it would constitute in substance vouching for the credibility of the child witness.
That's correct. And in fairness, he did talk about the CV, but the basis in his words were it would bolster the credibility of the witnesses.
Right, which is sort of maybe an indirect way to get at it, but it wasn't frontal.
That's correct. It was, and as in Wheat, it was a general objection. The court was aware.
Okay. Now, once it became clear, either in the closing or, you know, in argument, was there then an objection made, or was there a request for an instruction to try to focus the jury on what they shouldn't be concluding from the argument?
No, not with respect to this issue. But I would argue that a instruction wouldn't have helped here because this court, as I said, has found it clear and reversible error, and it was highlighted in the opening. And it was, you know, as this court has said, I just want to point out that in Graves, in particular, there was an attorney, again, who was put on the stand to say, my two clients came to me and they wanted to help the state, so I told them, go tell the truth to the prosecutors. And they said the same thing they said to me. And then he pontificated about his standing in the legal community. And the court said, quote, the net effect in this case was to bolster and enhance the testimony of two state witnesses even before they testified. In this case, it would be even before their statement was played. And the fact that the attorney testified regarding his professional attainments had one purpose, that a lawyer of his standing would not represent children who were not truthful. And here, by testifying to her qualifications, her techniques, and her opinion, and saying it's apparent when they're truthful, and here she is sponsoring it, it's at least indirect and should be reversed either on abuse of discretion or plain error.
I'm going to save the remainder of your time.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Wallace.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, Paul Wallace on behalf of the state. I'd like to clarify the record as to exactly how this unfolded because I suggest that the arguments that were made below are not quite exactly what were made here and in the briefing. If we start, first of all, with the fact that defense counsel was given the 3507 statement, and twice on the record, both at A8 and A22, made it clear that he agreed to the redactions that were made and everything else, and then clarified even after the statement was played that he agreed to the redactions he had read it. At A22 and 23 is the first discussion of calling Ms. Poley. And there, the prosecutor explained that she would lay the foundation, that Ms. Poley would explain the Raddick technique regarding questioning. And this exchange happened between the court and defense counsel, the court. That would be appropriate protocol. You agree, Mr. Wilkinson? Mr. Wilkinson, yes, Your Honor. So he knew exactly what it appeared Ms. Poley was going to say. They take a break, and the tape is given over, the tape that's actually going to go in, they have that marked, and the CV is discussed. And then Mr. Wilkinson objects to the curriculum vitae and says, yes, Your Honor, because I think it puts the tapes more of the complaining witness testify. I think the jury can make their own determination on credibility and everything else. The CV, since she's not really offering an opinion, I think it kind of bolsters other witnesses, not really her, you know, of Ms. Poley, since she's offering, and then he trails off. And the judge says, well, I'll allow questions about the victim's background and experience. And at the end of the ruling says that the CV is out and says, quote, the document itself, the CV, is not necessary. I'll exclude it. By all
intents. Did the court go on and say why the testimony can be given even though about the contents of the document, even though the document wasn't going to be?
Your Honor, I think the court understood that objection as exactly what it was. The CV, in his view, was cumulative. That it, now it's a document saying this is an expert and therefore you might have some belief that they have some greater credibility in giving an opinion or something else, and that wasn't going to happen. But then the judge says, he says, thank you, Your Honor. And then the judge says to Mr. Wilkinson, you can ask about background. And he says, thank you, Your Honor. So obviously he was objecting to that document as being cumulative, but understood that she was going to talk about how this statement comes about. It would be a very stilted and difficult thing to simply throw somebody up there and say, did you talk to this girl? Here's the tape.
Let's assume that what you've told us supports your contention that our standard of review is plain error.
Yes, Your Honor.
As a general proposition, when you're introducing a 3507 statement, what should the trier of fact know about the person who took the statement?
I think, Your Honor, In Jones versus State, for instance, not that it spoke directly, it was talking about the presence foundational part of 3507. But one of the things the court said is that you have to have certain parts of the foundation because it's necessary for the declarant or the witness to be in a position to respond to questions on cross or direct about the substance of the statement for the context in which the statement was made. So I think that it may differ as to how the trial unfolds. Many times, for instance, if it's a police officer, you will have already put those background questions in.
Well, here, just focusing on this, the person says, my name is X, I work for the Child Advocacy Center, and I took the statement and here's the content. What did the jury need to know beyond that?
Well, Your Honor, one, and it was spoken about at least twice, and that was the technique used for to question the child. And the reason is that it's kind of an unusual technique. She explained that.
And that's the purpose of my question. Once we get into the technique of the interviewer, aren't we more moving towards the interviewer being an expert? And then the question is more like qualify them under Powell versus Wheat. Let them give their opinion because this is something that people generally don't know. But if it's not, if the technique doesn't involve expertise, it's simply, here's the statement, why do we need to get into the technique? And I guess the real background of my question is, if you look at our jurisprudence in 3507, we've tried to narrow it to the statement of the declarant. And to the extent you're going to go beyond the statement of the declarant, and there has to be a really good reason to do that. And so in this particular case, why did the jury need, or why was it permissible for the jury to know about the technique?
Well, I think the technique is important. And by the way, Your Honor, it also ended up being important to the defense counsel, because part of the reason defense counsel didn't...
The question is, why is it important?
The reason that it is important is that it explains to the jury what they're about to see, which is a bit unusual because it's not the normal police officer sitting with a child. Nowhere did Officer Poli, in that introductory phase of explaining, here's the technique, say things like, and it's so that the child tells the truth, or this gets you truthful statements or anything. She just explains, bottom line, what's the RATC? Here's what you go through. And I suggest that it's important because the jury is going to see an interview that's different than what they might expect. It's different than a police officer sitting across from an adult where they simply ask them questions. And she explains, this is why, for instance, we start with a report, explaining that aspect.
Relate that to the statute. In the statute, 3507 says it's the witness's statement that comes in. We can put in the witness's statement without knowing any background or any context except it was an interview by someone. How does all of what you're talking about relate to the statute?
Well, as we mentioned in our brief, and I think that it's clear, that it also goes to the voluntariness of the statement because it explains the interaction between the child and the interviewer themselves. And yes, the child may say, it was okay, I went there and spoke, but that doesn't mean that that necessarily meets the foundation, and this court has held that the foundation for each piece may be made by the officer. And in fact, with the second witness, I'll use the pseudonym.
Was the voluntariness of the statement at issue in this case?
Oh, absolutely, in the second one. And not as to the first victim, Brenda, but as to the second one, absolutely. There were questions about voluntariness, and the defense, in fact, objected to voluntariness.
Well, and I think the thrust of Justice Holland's question, and certainly mine, is that if under the statute the only function of putting the interviewer on the witness stand is for the interviewer, in effect, to be a conduit in order to get the child's testimony before the jury, then why does the interviewer need to do anything other than to recite the child's testimony? Or, even granting that there may be some explanatory relevance to having the technique explained, for that technique to be explained in a clinically neutral way.
And I'd suggest respectfully, Your Honor, she did that in a clinically neutral way here.
Well, how can you say she did that when you know, that material included basically statements by the interviewer that this, I've been doing this, using this technique for 20 years, and we're able to call out, you know, testimony of children who are telling the truth from those that aren't.
Well, Your Honor, I think we need to separate out exactly what happened in relation to the tape and the foundation, and then a question that was asked after the tape and went not at all to this particular witness or to the foundation. Because what happened in the initial, if you read that initial part, which again, defense did not object to, and in fact, later on cross-examined her about, isn't it true that you did use leading questions in this? I mean, Mr. Wilkinson, we have to believe, made some strategic choices as to what he was going to do here also. He had seen the tape.
Well, let's stop for a minute so that I can understand. Who was it that adduced the testimony of the interviewer regarding, were able, you know, to determine which children are credible and which ones aren't?
Well,
that was the prosecutor, was it not?
The prosecutor never asked that question. What the prosecutor asked...
I didn't ask whether he asked the question. I asked whether he elicited the testimony.
Yes.
That I'm,
okay. A question that the prosecutrix asked in this question, in this case, led to that answer. But here was the answer. What the prosecutrix asked about was whether or not the person, a child basically, will sit down and give the entire story in one sitting. That's all she asked. Ms. Poley, in her response, unfortunately said, well, no, they don't. Sometimes they hold back, and said at one point in that, at A36, and this is after all the foundational, after the statement's been played, I think as far as truthfulness is apparent when you talk with a child and go through that, well, I think it's very obvious when they are being truthful. Now, first of all, there was no objection to that by the defense counsel. And in fact, the prosecutor immediately stopped her and said, wait a minute, that's not what I'm asking you. And in fact, went back and specifically said, do they always disclose to you everything that happened to them? And said, that's what I'm asking you. And she said, no, they don't. So it was an answer not expected. It wasn't part of the foundation.
Well, even that answer, it suggests, doesn't it, that this is a process that elicits the whole truth.
That's designed to attempt to do that, yes, Your Honor. But I'd suggest that given the context of what was going on at the time, first of all, defense counsel didn't object and the court didn't intervene, and I think it's because everybody understood she misspoke when she said that. And, in fact, the prosecutor immediately tried to correct it and did correct it, and that's why it didn't elicit it.
So this particular series of Q&A talking about eliciting the truth, and it's obvious, this is an outlier, this is not happening in every case.
No, it wasn't, and it wasn't eliciting the truth, it was asking about disclosure of everything at one point. That was the question that was asked. It talked about the evolving nature of disclosure sometimes, that when an interviewer sits down, it's not uncommon that the child doesn't explain the entirety of the event at one time.
Well, what is happening generally in terms of explaining this RADAC technique?
I believe what you see at A32 and 33, Your Honor, and it's the interviewer comes in, explains why they work, explains their background briefly and generally, says, here's what we do, we use this technique, and then basically plays a tape. And if you look at the actual A32 through 33, that's precisely what happened, and it was clinical, to use Justice Jacobs' wording. There wasn't any value to, and this is how we get to the truth, or anything like that. It's, here's what we do. We were poor billed, we go through this, we go through that, we go through this. And I do believe that it is important, one, I do believe that it goes to the voluntariness, because the jury has to understand how this child comes to be with this person and is going to talk about things that a child would never probably want to talk about. And it also gives some background so that the jury understands the context of this discussion. Why is this interview done this way? Because when you watch these interviews, you start off with really not talking about much of anything, just kind of getting to know the child and the rapport building and things like that. And so it explains for the jury so that they can watch it and understand why the interviewer is doing what the interviewer is doing before they get to actually talking about the incident.
So your position is that rapport building is part of the person's 3507 statement.
Yes, because it's in these circumstances, it's part of the 3507 statement because it gets the jury to understand, it gives jury the context of when they get to the actual discussion of here's the incident, here's what we're talking about. Because many times they loop back into that rapport building is, you know, who lives in your home, who are your brothers and sisters, all of those types of things. And many times you have to loop back into, okay, is that, you know, the Tommy that you were talking about earlier and things like that. So it is a process that is unusual, perhaps, for somebody who's never seen it before. Yeah. And I suggest this very brief background is appropriate.
All right, well, be that as it may, I gather that your position is that although the prosecutor elicited the testimony that's disputed here, the prosecutor didn't intend to do that.
The second portion after
right.
the tape, absolutely.
All right.
That's
not at all where
she's going. In fact, she specifically said it, and I think everybody in the courtroom
okay.
understood that.
And I think you also added that at that point there was no objection from defense counsel.
No
application for the trial court to intervene.
None.
Had the defense counsel objected at that point and asked the court to intervene, what would have been the proper thing for the prosecutor to do?
I think exactly what the prosecutor did, because she made it clear on the stand, look, that's not what I'm asking you, Detective Poley, and I don't think there would have been any problem with the prosecutor saying, Your Honor, to the extent you think there needs to be some curative to clarify that even further.
Let me ask the question differently. Let's assume, hypothetically, that defense counsel at that point asked the judge to give a curative instruction. Would the proper thing for the prosecution be for the prosecution to join in that motion?
Yes.
No.
Excuse me?
No.
Yes, it would be.
It would be, okay.
Yes, I think it would be absolutely appropriate. And I think that seeing how it unfolded in front of the jury when the prosecutor tried to correct it herself, that absolutely would have happened. But I think that's one of those situations, and as this court said time and again, we trust the trial judge to know the tenor and tone of what's going on in the courtroom. And nobody picked this up as this witness saying, this girl's absolutely telling the truth, you have to believe it because of my technique and everything else like that. She misspoke as she was trying to explain a different aspect of
the
interaction.
What are the parameters of explanatory background on interviewing technique? In an adult context, is it appropriate for the police to explain to a jury that, well, we use the good cop, bad cop technique because it elicits the whole truth, or we use a mutton Jeff, whatever might be a descriptive term. How far can you go with that? If this is okay here, would that be okay in that context?
I think that you may be able to ask that the police officer may be able to explain the technique in kind of terms of this is what we do, but not this is why we do it. Because in our belief, we get more truthful statements or something like that. I think that would be inappropriate. And that didn't happen here.
Well, at what point can the inference be drawn that this whole purpose of RADAC or any other interview technique is to reveal the whole truth? And that's what happened here.
Well, certainly that is one inference, that it is a technique that is used to try to get the best or most truthful evidence before to make a determination by. But I do believe that when the officer, him or herself, or the interviewer, him or herself, then puts some value on it, saying, and this is the best, and this is how I know it's truthful, or makes some opinion, him or herself, to the direct statement, saying, and because I use this technique, I knew that it's, you can trust whatever said here. I do believe that that's where it crosses the line. I think that an explanation of a technique that's used without that opinion, that either because it is the best or because, you know, I got a truthful statement out of it here, I think that's where the line is crossed. And I do think that this officer I'm sorry, I knew Detective Poley as an officer much longer than I knew her as an interviewer, but I do believe that her use, her explanation of this is what I did, this is why I'm here, this is the technique that we used, here's the statement, is allowable and appropriate.
Well, so you're, tell me if I have this right, your position is number one, that this, given the way this issue came up in the trial court, the standard of review is plain error.
Yes.
Number two, that if it was error, it wasn't plain. And I guess the question I have is number three, was it error at all?
I would suggest the first portion, the interview, the introductory portion was not error at all. The slip up by the detective afterwards was.
It was error, but it wasn't plain.
It wasn't plain, and it wasn't plain because. It wasn't plain because it was, I think, confused. I think that as we look at it in black and white, in the cool of this courtroom now, it probably jumps out much more at us than it did in those circumstances because it was immediately discussed and clarified. If it's error at all, it was
because
harmless.
The impact in the real in real time was unclear. Is that
yes.
What you're saying?
Yes, and that the prosecutor took corrective steps immediately when she sensed anything wrong. That is all my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think a broader look at that testimony shows it wasn't a slip up. The prosecutor asked about the disclosure process. And so she, first of all, is opining as to a process that occurs, which she's not qualified to do. And in the answering of that question, Ms. Pauley says, so it just goes to show that they are not always going to respond to somebody's questions with truthful responses like that because it's a process for them. And then she goes on further. Then the prosecutor says, you just said something a little confusing. You said you're not going to always get a truthful answer from them. There was really no reason for her to continue to highlight that at that point. And the prior question was lengthy, the prior answer was lengthy, and then the question beyond that was lengthy. In any event, the techniques were not described in a clinical fashion. One of the things in particular that was problematic was that she testified as to one of the precautions was making sure police don't interview the complainants about the details because they don't want to interview them because it doesn't give the child much credibility.
Well, Ms. Walker, everything you say highlights the background for my next question. Why didn't the defense attorney say, I object, what does this have to do with the child's 3507 statement? I mean, this went on at length. And you would think after all this court's written about the narrowness of 3507 statements, it would occur to defense counsel that this really seemed pretty far afield from introducing a 3507 statement. So the dilemma for us on appeal is this something that should be addressed in a direct appeal under a plain error standard, or is it something that should be addressed in Rule 61 for ineffective assistance of counsel when a record can be developed?
Your Honor, respectfully, it's ripe for direct appeal. The answer is I don't know why he didn't object to that. I will say, in answer to Judge Ridgely's question earlier, this isn't an outlying case. And, of course, I don't have all the cases in front of me, but I think reviewing child advocacy cases after child advocacy cases, this comes up repeatedly. And the only thing I can think of is that...
What is the this you're referring to?
Oh, I'm sorry. The going into the techniques and it becoming wishy-washy as respect to the opinion, and it was not done in a clinical matter, in a clinical fashion here. Your Honor, no further record would be developed that could be helpful here. As this court has said, it's plain and reversible error if one witness testifies as to the veracity of another, and it said that more than once, and it said that in a situation where the attorney even invited error. This is a credibility case, and this child advocate was able to vouch for the witnesses.
Ms. Walker, and without intending to put words in Mr. Wallace's mouth, I understood him to say that, you know, plain error isn't determined in a vacuum. Whether or not the error is plain has to be viewed in the context in which the error occurred, and here the impact, if any, on the jury in real time was, you know, very unclear. Therefore, if there was error, and I think there was a concession that there was error, it certainly wasn't plain. What is your response?
First of all, this court needs to, and in Campana versus State, the court stated that harm analyzed based on extent is to be analyzed on the extent of the state's case. Excuse me. The harm analyzed depends on the extent to which the jury is to rely on the witness who's being vouched for their testimony. This is a credibility case, and so therefore it does amount to plain error. It isn't a vacuum. If we were talking about just that one statement that he says was confusing, it would be a closer call. We're not talking about that. She said, if I may just make one more response, if I could go back to the point where she
You're saying the entire line of questioning was highlighting this, not just one inadvertent blurb.
Correct. And when she said they don't, please don't interview because they don't want to affect the credibility, the detective later testified that he followed that process, also vouching.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.
Thank you.